This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Ariel Sabar, author of a book titled Veritas, subtitled A Harvard Professor, A Con Man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. The Harvard professor is Dr. Karen King, a widely respected biblical scholar in the Divinity School at Harvard University. When the book begins, she's just been promoted to the Hollis Professorship of Divinity, the oldest endowed chair in America, and one of the most prestigious posts in the study of Christianity. Ariel Sabar was first introduced to her when he was commissioned by the Smithsonian Magazine to report on the discovery of a piece of papyrus that Dr. King said offered conclusive evidence for the assertion, raised by the writer Dan Brown, among others, that Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene were married. This is an excerpt from the audiobook of the novel, read by Robert Petkoff, which begins with a poem voiced by a female god.
Do not be ignorant of me, for I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am control and the uncontrollable. I am the union and the dissolution. The Thunder, Perfect Mind. Solicitations. Dr. Karen Lee King had reached the summit of her field as a dazzling interpreter of condemned scripture. On her bookshelves at Harvard Divinity School were ancient texts as mysterious as they were startling. Among them were the Sophia of Jesus Christ, the secret revelation of John, and the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Mary, as in Magdalene, was a favorite. So was The Thunder, Perfect Mind, a poem voiced by a female god whose paradoxical self-affirmations King found incredibly inclusive. Such writings were nowhere to be found in the church-sanctioned collection of sacred literature, commonly known as the New Testament. Early bishops had rejected them as heresies and sought their eradication. For hundreds of years, no one knew what became of them. But in the late 1800s, fragments of papyrus bearing traces of these lost scriptures began turning up at archaeological sites and antiquities shops across Egypt. The story they told about the earliest centuries of Christianity would force historians to re-examine almost everything they thought they knew about the world's predominant faith. The more pieces of papyrus the deserts disgorged, the more the official history of Christianity, the master story, as King called it, began to look like a lie. To King, these newly unearthed texts were the missing pieces of a Bible that might have been, had history taken a different course. In the suppressed writings of ancient believers, she saw a Christianity more open-armed and less taken with violence than the one passed down by the long line of powerful popes and Sunday sermonizers. We are only beginning to construct the pieces of a fuller and more accurate narrative of Christian beginnings, she declared. The dry desert of Egyptian Africa has yielded a feast for the nourishment of the mind, and perhaps for the spirit as well. When colleagues published a book celebrating her scholarship, they titled it Remaking the World. In a quiet voice, they wrote, she has changed the face of early Christian studies. As an eminent Harvard historian of banished gospels, King could pack a college lecture hall nearly anywhere in the world. But students weren't the only ones who sought her instruction. Her work at the fringes of faith drew notice from mystics, conspiracists, and mediums, some of whom regarded her as a bearer of secret knowledge. One email correspondent sent her a code he said unlocked the mysteries of the Bible. Another asked for the key to the seemingly random order of Jesus' sayings in the apocryphal Gospel of Thomas. Some woman offered me true facts about Mary Magdalene because she told me, I am Mary Magdalene, King recalled. I get a lot of that kind of stuff.
It seems to me, thinking about your book and the success of your book, that that is in part perhaps a reflection of the moment. There is at the moment a conflict between the notion of belief and of fact. And many people who characterize themselves as believers have a tendency, at least in my experience, to often talk about that which they believe as fact. And that seems, as a journalist, I would think that you'd be acutely sensitive to that blurring of the line between belief and what we sort of commonly accept as fact, as that which can be rationalized and can also be proven.
Right, right. I mean, I think that gets to really one of the sort of central themes of the book, which, you know, after all, is titled Veritas. Now, Veritas, of course, is Harvard University's, 400-year-old slogan, and it's the Latin word for truth. And, of course, you know, this is a story about a Harvard professor, you know, who claimed to discover this sort of groundbreaking new gospel. But it also speaks very much, I think, to the moment we're in which, you know, there are these disputes over what counts as fact, as factual. And there are different approaches to the truth. I mean, I think as a journalist, I'm very much an empiricist. You know, it's sort of a fancy word for someone who believes they can sort of go out into the world, interview people, look at documents, visit places, talk to people, and arrive at some, you know, pretty good version of the truth. I don't think we ever get it entirely, but we aspire to it. And we believe that, you know, the more digging, the more investigating we do, the closer we can get to it. And I think that's true of scientists as well. And hopefully it's true of scholars. But I think, you know, when one goes into a place of worship, you know, whatever your faith happens to be, you don't necessarily need to use those same standards. I mean, you're very clearly in a place in which sort of the rules for deciding whether something is true or have changed, because faith is, you know, almost by definition, a belief in things unseen and unproven. And that's okay. And I think what becomes troublesome, and I think one of the things that I treat in this investigative work of investigative journalism that the book is places where those two ways of approaching the truth get uncomfortably blurry, I think, as you put it, where people sort of forget whether they're doing scholarship or whether they're producing a kind of an article of faith for the faithful. And I think wires got crossed in some pretty interesting ways in the story of the so-called gospel of Jesus's wife, which was the forgery that this Harvard professor introduced to the world as real back in 2012 when I first started covering the story.
Whereas journalism is often comfortable with who, what, where, and when you start to try to answer why questions, which seems to be what interests you the most, first of all, I think you, by definition, to some degree, are going out on a limb. But the people who commissioned the work from you were also going out on a limb, weren't they, from the first piece you wrote, which I think was for the Smithsonian?
Yeah, Smithsonian Magazine, right.
Did they commission you to cover this story Dr. King?
Yeah, it was really strange. You know, I was actually, you know, I had been a newspaper journalist for more than a decade and then wrote my first book, which was sort of a story of my father's immigrant journey from the mountains of Iraq to Southern California. And then I started writing for magazines, and I was a relatively new freelancer for Smithsonian Magazine. I think I had only filed one other piece, and so was really sort of struck one day when, out of the blue, I get a call at home from one of the top editors there who I had no prior dealings with. I thought maybe I'd done something wrong. When you get a call from an editor who you've never spoken to before and is higher ranking than the editor you're usually dealing with, it may not always be good news. But he said, no, look, we've gotten a scoop, early access to this unbelievable, seemingly unbelievable discovery by a very prominent Harvard professor who has claimed to find this, you know, piece of papyrus, ancient writing surface, on which is written what appears to be the first reference in any ancient text to Jesus having a wife. And, you know, the sort of headline-making line in the middle of this fragment, and it is just a fragment, was Jesus said to them, quote, my wife. And so it seemed to be, you know, a discovery with the potential to sort of remake Christian tradition. You know, certainly the idea of a celibate Jesus is one that is part of that tradition. And so, you know, I was, they basically said, look, the professor's going to announce this at a scholarly conference in Rome in about 3 weeks. How would you like to go to Harvard, see the papyrus, interview her, and then follow her to Rome? And, you know, I think even the Smithsonian, because very highly respected magazine, you know, it's affiliated with the Smithsonian institutions. And they, you know, it was very clear to me from that conversation with the editor that we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't coming from Harvard. I mean, Harvard brings with it a certain level of credibility. I mean, the idea that there would be a discovery like this, you know, there are a lot of fakes out there around the Bible because people create fakes that they want to sell to wealthy collectors. They create fakes to sort of change history or to change the practice of faith. And I think that what really gave the Smithsonian Magazine confidence that this was a story that was worth pursuing, worth investigating at the very least, writing about, even if it would be controversial, was that this was a discovery that came out of the world's, you know, most prestigious university, the wealthiest and most powerful university in the world. And Harvard, you know, Harvard has a certain reputation. And so I think that gave them confidence that, you know, we should be covering this. If it does make headlines, we want to be there, you know, to sort of help break the story.
Okay. We've already established that to some degree, the Bible is a construct. It's written by men of faith. But the very fact that some of the stories were excised and others weren't, and as you called it, the authorized version, that by definition is saying that the Bible is basically a story.
Sure. I mean, I think that's the way, and I, you know, scholars are certainly the folks that consult on that. But yes, I mean, having done the readings of how modern scholarship thinks about the Bible is, yes, it's a story. If you're a person of faith, if you're a devout Christian, if you're an evangelical, devout Catholic, you view the New Testament as sort of the unfiltered, literal Word of God, and that's how people of those sort of denominations view it. However, you know, modern scholars will look at it much like any other piece of ancient literature. It's a story, and there's a sort of an authorized version of the story that got kind of sort of a seal of approval from the early bishops, and then there are other parts of the story that didn't make it. And if you're devout, if you're deeply conservative, you'll view the reasons for the exclusion of these other stories as God-given. They will describe these texts as heretical, you know, the work of the devil. Sure, there were people trying to say all kinds of things about Jesus. Doesn't mean they were true. It just means that they were, you know, there were people trying to compromise the Word of God. Scholars don't see it that way. Scholars sort of leave the God part out of it. And they say, we have this text, it's called the New Testament. How did it get to be that way? And what's interesting, of course, is that, you know, whether you're, you know, Protestant or Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, your version of the New Testament is a little bit different. So even within the sort of established denominations of Christianity, you will find, you know, that certain texts are included in one group sort of version of sort of list of authorized texts and another group isn't. Although, you know, many of the texts that they're sort of called Gnostic or non-canonical, those tend not to appear in any traditions. Text. I can give you a few examples, like the Gospel of Mary, for instance, or the Gospel of Philip. These are legitimately authentic Gospels in that they tell a kind of story about Jesus. However, early bishops decided that they should not be in the sort of official collection of sacred texts.
And it strikes me that in some sense we're sort of talking about eyewitness testimony. And as we all know, eyewitness testimony from one to another can be very different, even though it's
sure.
The same event.
Sure, and I think the scholars would also point out that, you know, even the earliest gospel is thought to have been written, you know, 40 years after the crucifixion. So even the question of whether there were any eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus who wrote the story down, scholars would tell you that there aren't, not that we know of. So at very best, if one you know does believe, you know, the records that we have are. Would be memories that were passed down and then recorded, you know, at the very earliest 40 years after the life of Jesus.
All of which, in my mind, to some degree at least, answers the question which seemed to be one of the principal responses to your book. How is it that a scholar with the reputation and the experience of Dr. Karen King at Harvard could be so easily duped by what turned out to be not an especially accomplished forgery.
Yeah, I mean, that's really one of the big mysteries and one that I spent, you know, a good deal of research trying to sort of track down. I don't think what you can ever sort of stare into the soul of another human being, but I think that there are certainly enough evidence and breadcrumbs in the story to piece together what happened. I mean, and the story, you know, the Veritas, my book is written like a detective story. So people have to sort of, you know, turn the pages to figure out how it was that, you know, one of the most prestigious scholars, the holder of the oldest endowed professorship in all of North America, could be taken in by a college dropout who was a motorcycle riding pornographer who had like a few years of graduate education. How does that happen? And it's a fascinating story. And I think, you know, I think in some ways it's a tragedy because I think what Karen King has sought to do with her scholarship is in some ways, I think a lot of people would say, see as praiseworthy. I mean, what she's trying to do and what she has done successfully for many years is to recover some of these lost voices of women in early Christianity. The women, the female figures, whether you think that they were simply characters in a story or whether you believe they actually lived, you know, whether we're talking about Mary Magdalene, who was certainly central to Karen King's research, or Eve, or Sophia, to bring these characters or these people to greater prominence and say, look, there were women in early Christianity who were powerful, who were very close to Jesus, and in some ways, they've been written out of the story. Scholars agree with that there's not a lot of dispute that happened. What makes this a tragedy is that this was sort of an overreach. The Gospel of Jesus's Wife, that was, by the way, a title she gave to this fragment. There's nowhere on this fragment, which is just a series of like eight broken lines, does the title Gospel of Jesus' Wife appear. So she gave it a very provocative title. And then she announced it across the street from the Vatican and in stories that were covered on the front pages of the New York Times and the Boston Globe. So this was an instance in which there was a piece of evidence that sort of filled, it was sort of a missing link in her scholarship. So her scholarship has sort of brought the field to a certain point, but it hadn't done this one other thing, which was to portray Mary Magdalene as both a disciple of Jesus and someone who was physically with him, close to him, not just spiritually close to him, but the physical relationship of a man to wife. And that was something King had lamented in her, that we didn't have any ancient texts that did that. And she openly lamented this. And so what the so-called Gospel of Jesus' Wife did is it portrayed Mary Magdalene, who was both the wife of Jesus and was defended by Jesus as someone capable of being one of his closest disciples. And so it's really amazing as a work of forgery in that these just eight fragmentary lines, all you need is two of those lines to make both of those points. The fourth line is, Jesus said to them, my wife, therefore Jesus has a wife. The next one is, she is able to be my disciple. And so basically in two broken lines of Coptic, the forger, the modern forger, was able to take aim at sort of two of the sort of pillars of Catholic tradition and also raise questions about, you know, priestly celibacy, the refusal of the church to ordain women, which is, you know, still very much in the news, and sort of the ancillary sort of saga of the child abuse scandal within the Catholic Church.
I can sympathize with Dr. King's desire to take an open-minded approach to scholarship. The fact that ultimately, from an academic point of view, this is an open-ended argument that is never going to be resolved because ultimately the proof doesn't exist. So when she was presented with something that would appear to be proof that takes the argument in a totally different direction, it's easy to understand why she would embrace it so wholly when from the outside the assumption would be a person in her position would have to be so careful to put her imprimatur and by extension the imprimatur of Harvard on any kind of assertion like this.
And that's what I think really makes it an interesting human veritas, an interesting human story. And I really try to tell it with sort of compassion for all of the characters. You know, readers may decide that they're good guys and gals and bad guys and gals. But I think, you know, I really wanted to leave that judgment to readers. And I think you're right. I think she was, you know, she was reaching the end of her career. She wanted people to have these kinds of conversations. She wanted believers to have conversations, modern believers to have difficult conversations about their faith with an eye to reforming their faith and making it, I think, more inclusive. And I think this is where that line we talked about earlier, like if you're a theologian or you're a minister, you lead a congregation, and I think you're asking your congregation to reckon with those questions in the context of faith. But when you're doing it as a scholar, you're supposed to be using different standards. You're supposed to be, you know, evidence matters, data matters. And so, you know, I think what became tricky here for Karen King is that she does sort of straddle these two worlds. She works at Harvard Divinity School, which is unusual among, you know, the top schools in the United States in that all of the religious studies at Harvard is basically centered around the Harvard Divinity School. Harvard does not have a freestanding Department of Religious Studies the way many, many other universities do. So it straddles this line between we are training ministers, non-denominational ministers, it's not affiliated with any denomination, non-denominational ministers to tend to a flock within their houses of worship, but we are also training people to have PhDs in the academic study of religion. And, you know, there's an open question I heard while reporting the book about whether that's the right way to do it, whether it might be better to separate those two. But Harvard is very sort of proud of its tradition, although, you know, many of the new hires who are being hired at Harvard to teach religion, who I spoke to, interviewed for the book, said it doesn't really work. There are too many opportunities for wires to cross and for the kinds of problems that led to the publication of The Gospel of Jesus' Wife to recur.
It strikes me that the biggest challenge for you is that you're writing a story about stories. And by definition, to write a story is as much what you leave out as what you leave in.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it raises all those sort of meta questions because, you know, for me, I think the frame that I wanted to use was one, this sort of detective story frame, because I think that was fitting for a story like this, which was a mystery for so long. I mean, when Karen King announced the discovery in 2012, scholars, you know, top scholars in her field sort of revolted. I mean, there was a sense right away that, you know, the handwriting on the papyrus had no ancient precedent. There were way too many errors in spelling and grammatical errors in this very small papyrus. It just couldn't be explained as something an ancient writer would do. It also looked like you could sort of piece together the Gospel of Jesus' Wife by cleverly cutting and pasting phrases from an apocryphal gospel known as the Gospel of Thomas. So it really started out as a mystery. I mean, I think in the conventional mystery, you start with a dead body, right? And then the detective figures out who did it. In this story, we started with a fishy papyrus and then figured out who did it and tried to figure out who did it. So for me, I really tried to stay true. Yes, as a storyteller and a journalist, you always make decisions about how to structure a story. But I felt like the truest structure, the one that would do the greatest service to the way in which this actually unfolded, was the detective story. And so, I tried to play it, you know, pretty straight. I think, you know, some reviewers have said, like, you know, I'm not coming in, you know, with both guns blazing. I think I really try to write it in a way that let readers come to their own conclusions. I present evidence, I lead them down the trail, and I certainly am leading them because I've written the book. But I try to have the tone be sort of neutral enough and non-judgmental enough, you know, to let readers come to their own sense of what actually happened here.
What kind of reaction have you had to the book?
It's been really sort of across the waterfront. I mean, a lot of people have been sort of aghast at what they saw at Harvard, which is supposed to, you know, embody the highest, very highest standards of veritas, of empirical research, that something like this could make it into the world without all the checks that, you know, are supposed to happen in scholarship. And I write quite a bit about the failures of peer review, about the conflicts of interest that I discovered that were not public before, that led to the publication of this papyrus. So there are people who are just sort of aghast at how something like this could enter the world at a place that's supposed to be as rigorous as Harvard. The scholars who are just sort of embarrassed by the whole episode, that are upset and feel like, you know, Karen King did a disservice to her own field, because there's a lot of really wonderful feminist scholarship. There's a lot of really good feminist scholarship in biblical studies. And, you know, this, of course, this case got a lot of attention. This case was not an example. this was the sort of an example of where the scholarship didn't really work. And so I've also heard from people, or heard of people, who've said, you know, this really sets, what makes this a tragedy is that it damages the very thing Karen King held dearest, which is the notion of opening up the Christian faith to a more egalitarian view of women, and or women in early Christianity, women in present day congregations. And so to the extent that this set back that effort, it was sort of a tragedy. And then there are also people, readers, who've written like, oh, this is so disappointing. Like, I really liked the idea that that Jesus might have been married. It seemed perfectly consistent with the kind of person Jesus was. And I really was hopeful of it, that this might be real. And I don't approve necessarily of how this all went about, but I'm a little bummed. So that has also been another reader response, and a perfectly reasonable one, because, you know, that again, that's what faith is. If you view it as just a story, then you can. I mean, in sort of your flights of fancy, you know, depending on how comfortable you are in your belief, say, you know, when I think about the kind of person, you know, Jesus or whoever it is you worship was, I'm comfortable with this more egalitarian view of him. I don't need to be able to footnote that. I don't need to be able to sort of footnote it to some ancient text to allow me to validate that view. I do it because that's what faith is. It allows me to take those spiritual explorations just because I can. And so it's interesting, again, this gets back to the earlier questions we were talking about of like, do I need to be able to footnote my faith? Or is faith the whole point of faith that you don't need footnotes?
It strikes me that that's what the pandemic did for all of us. Was made us realize that anything that we just take at face value, that we just accept is the way it is, it isn't. Whether we're talking about articles of faith or we're talking about everyday life, everything at this point in time has been thrown into flux. And so perhaps this is an ideal time to raise this discussion of
faith means. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you've heard pundits use the term sort of like post-truth, you know, post-factual. I think post-truth and post-factual is a really, really scary place to be. I think, you know, the idea that we all are inexorably partisan, that we're all just members of a tribe, that we can only see things through the lens of the people we already agree with, that really undermines, I think, not just scholarship, where you're supposed to be able to have healthy debates with people you disagree with while still respecting them, but also our democracy. I think to the extent that we no longer can share a sense of what is true, and when we've lost the tools to discover what's true, and we don't even agree anymore whether those tools work, I think that really is a dangerous place both for scholarship and civic life.
The book by Ariel Sabar titled Veritas, subtitled A Harvard Professor, a Con Man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, has just been published in paperback. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.